Welcome to BookWaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Joseph O'Neill, whose new novel is Netherland, earlier novels, This is the Life, and The Breezes, and a nonfiction book, Blood Dark Track, a Family History. Netherland has been called the first great 9/11 novel. The book began before 9/11 happened. You were writing the book already, right?
I first got the idea of writing about the New York cricket world in 98 when I started playing cricket in New York, and then that idea became inextricable from what happened on September 11.
Originally, the main character was this character, Chuck, who was a Trinidadian cricket player, but somewhere along the line, the character of Hans, who bears a certain resemblance in terms of personal history to you, Joseph O'Neill, became the main character. You said at one point in an earlier interview that the character of Chuck Ramkissoon, you couldn't quite make it work as a central character.
Well, you know, I'd met this guy in real life who had tried, a Pakistani guy, actually, who lived in New York City, a rich man who'd made his money in Canada, whose dream it was to build a cricket stadium in New York City, and so this intrigued me. And I wanted to kind of write a novel about business, because I always felt that the business world, you know, there's never been fully dramatized in a way which I'd find satisfactory. So I thought this crazy guy tries to build a stadium in New York City. But as I progressed with that idea, I needed somebody to tell the story. And then, as often happens with these things, you start becoming interested in the person who's telling the story and why he's telling it. And then once you start thinking about those things, then suddenly your novel is about this displaced Dutchman who lives in New York City and who makes friends with a Trinidadian immigrant.
At what point, then, in that process did 9/11 happen?
Well, the first thing I suppose to say about 9/11 is that I was living in New York, and like every other person, not just in New York, but everywhere, I didn't see it in terms of its relationship to the particular project I was working on. So a little while after, maybe in the year that followed, it became obvious that something related was going on in New York City, in the country, something which had to do with the American perception of the outside world. And I always thought of cricket in the United States as a kind of emblem of that which America cannot really see or understand. And so the two started to become fused, and then one thing led to another.
So at the point that, in fact, 9/11 occurred, were you in a diner at the time watching it?
I was. Actually, at that time, I was about to publish my last book, my memoir, which was a political history of my family, and which, in retrospect, is possibly my real 9/11 book. It's all about how a political conscience is formed and the role of family in that. But on the day in question, I think we all remember where we were. On that day in question, I live in the Chelsea Hotel in New York City, and I went down to the lobby, and someone said a plane has crashed into the World Trade Center, and I, like everyone else, I thought it was probably one of these private planes that had just gone lost. I had no idea. And then just as I walked to my regular diner to have breakfast, I looked over the counter, and there in the was this TV behind the counter, and there was this extraordinary sight of the plane hitting the second plane, hitting the building.
Had you gone outside to see the smoke and everything, too?
I think my first reaction at that point was to go back home and be with my family, and then we decided that I should go shopping, buy food, buy provisions, because it also became clear at that point that there were further attacks going on in Washington and elsewhere. We had no idea what was going on, and so I immediately went to the supermarket and bought, you know, food for the next couple of weeks. So shopping, yeah, and it's not my normal instinct to go shopping. And then a friend of mine, who was another writer who lives in the building, said to me, you know, why don't we go down and see what's happening? I was going to do that. My wife was against that, and I should have stayed home with my family, and so that's what I did.
But at that point, you were writing this cricket story or thinking about
it. I was thinking about it, yeah.
Yeah, and you were still trying to put it in context. One thing that you make clear in interviews, which is also in the book, is that 9/11 really is kind of a two-pronged thing. The first was the attack, and the second is how the Bush administration used that attack to essentially invade another country and to do all kinds of damage around the world. And it's my sense that, without being explicit, you wanted to make sure that was in the book.
you know, I have very strong opinions personally about that. But, you know, as a novelist, you know, one of the things you have to resist is sort of is having your characters being reduced to your mouthpieces. But what did happen, there was political debate, there was active political discussion at the time. And so I made the wife of my main character the one whose views are actually quite similar to mine. And she does sound quite strident about it, but then so do I. And so did a lot of people. And, of course, my main character, as kind of befits a sort of nuanced and kind of interesting observer, is actually at a loss about what to do with anything. He's not politically minded. He's also quite a sort of rationalist. So he takes the rather logical but politically hopeless view that in relation to the war in Iraq, since we don't know what the future holds, we cannot say in advance that the war in Iraq is necessarily a bad thing. He doesn't know how it's going to turn out. Therefore, how can he make the judgment? Not realizing, or realizing, but, you know, but not reacting on the realization that the whole business of being political is to make those difficult judgments as best you can.
Hans himself, despite having aspects of your history, particularly growing up in Holland, is a mostly passive character throughout. Chuck is the one who convinces him to drive around, to take a driving test. Rachel is the one who decides to leave him and decides to go back. In fact, the only move he makes that's his, really, is to move back to London and leave New York, and that seems more like a move of desperation than anything else.
Well, he compares it to the sudden and rather mysterious movement of flocking birds when you see them flying in the air, and then they suddenly veer right, and you don't know why we don't know why they're doing it. I think what happens is that he has no one left in America. I mean, it's at that moment, I mean, he has this remarkable and sustaining friendship with this charismatic Trinidadian entrepreneur. And then he discovers that Chuck, this man, has a dark side to him, which is that he's involved in sort of gangster-like, gangsterish activities of one kind or another. And he sort of, that friendship essentially comes to an abrupt end at that point. And once that friendship comes to an end, then he really has nobody left. And he sees that he has no option but to go back to England. And he's ready to go back and ready to deal more directly with his family situation.
He's never even aware until she leaves him that there's a problem in the relationship. And I find that interesting because in a lot of relationships that's true, but I've never seen it really done that way in a novel.
Well, I think he's aware of his own misery, and he's aware of his wife's misery, and he's aware of the tiredness. But he's not a man who's kind of versed in the American habit of analyzing relationships, possibly because of his childhood in Holland, which was a very innocent childhood. He sees, approach him out of this fog almost, be it his wife, be it his friends, be it his people who have something against him. And he is passive. And so the wife assumes the responsibility of initiating the separation and of thinking hard about why it is that, despite the fact that they're married, both of them, each of them is terribly lonely. And she's the one who says, if that is the case, then the situation isn't right.
Joseph O'Neill, there's so many aspects to this book, and I'd like to cover a few of them. Trinidad, Chuck gives a long monologue about his life in Trinidad, and you spent 10 years as a barrister in London. You had a lot of Trinidadian clients. Did you ever go to Trinidad?
I did go to Trinidad. Let me just explain so that people know where I'm coming from, how a London lawyer comes to have Trinidad clients. I was a barrister in London, and I was mainly a business barrister. I would deal with commercial disputes. But the other thing I would do is I would do death penalty appeals. And the West Indian former colonies have as their final court of appeal London, and they choose to have it so as to insulate their legal process from corruption and various other disadvantages. And so I would receive these letters from death row in Trinidad, asking for legal advice, and which I would do my best to respond to. And eventually I went to Trinidad in relation to one particular man and began to take an interest in this extraordinary island. And then when I came to New York, the cricket team I played for consisted mainly of Trinidadians. And so I went to Trinidad on cricket tour with them. And, of course, these are men who come from the countryside. They come from, I suppose you would say, the kind of rural poor of Trinidad. You know, these friends of mine, and I would get to know their lives in Trinidad.
And you put that in the context of cricket in New York, and as someone growing up in New York who never, ever knew there was anything about cricket, and as certainly most of my friends from New York and my family probably knows there's nothing about cricket, you played cricket in Holland, right?
I did, yeah.
And you were pretty good at it.
Well, I mean, playing cricket in Holland is a bit like playing baseball in Romania. you know, you can be pretty good in Romania. Then you come back to the States and suddenly you're not that good. But I was pretty good at it. I was pretty good. I was a handy player. I wouldn't say I was particularly special, but I played for Holland and the under 19 team. But I've always been on the margins with cricket. And then I went to England and I played there. And then I came here. And I, maybe it's because I grew up playing in Holland that I was able to play in New York. With one or two rare exceptions, I was the only European playing cricket in New York.
Did you know cricket existed before you got the phone call from the president of the World Cricket League?
I called the president of the World Cricket League. I wasn't aware that he was the president of the World Cricket League. I found this organization in the White Pages, and this guy said, I'm the president of the World Cricket League. And I knew, I knew there must be cricket in New York. I had no real idea where. But I know the cricket players, and I know that they will pop up when you least expect them.
And you play in Staten Island.
Yeah.
The location where they play there.
Yeah, Staten Island Cricket Club.
Is there a decaying field out in Brooklyn, in Flatbush?
You know, Chuck decides to build his stadium on a place called Floyd Bennett Field, you know, which is a famous old airfield, which is now a park. It's one of the ugliest, kind of most mysterious parks you'll ever find, because it's just an old airstrip, and it's a national park. So people go there, and they're slightly baffled about what to do. There's nothing to do there. Occasionally, cricketers will play there, and I thought this would be a good place for him to plot to build his stadium.
I'm a baseball fan, and I know football,
yeah.
And I know basketball, and I followed hockey. And I can follow them. Soccer, I assume, is similar to hockey, British football, that
yeah.
I could follow it. Rugby, I know nothing about. And cricket, I've tried to watch it. And then I've read your book. I can't follow it, even with your description. Now, the question is this. When you were writing the book, you knew most people couldn't. And you had to be careful about that, right?
Well, I thought it was precisely the incomprehensibility of cricket which made it such a good subject for the American reader, because I wanted to confront the American reader with the incomprehensible. It's so easy if you're a member of the superpower culture to restrict your interest in the world to that which is yours, that which you own, or that which you control and understand. More challenging is to be confronted by that which you don't own, that which you don't understand. And actually, you know what's really encouraging is how receptive people have been to this book in this country. I think it's almost as if people are ready now. They're ready to sort of embrace complexity and they're ready to learn something. I'm sort of hoping that that's a sort of zeitgeist thing which will translate itself into the political culture at large.
Which may be optimistic on your part after watching the media this political season.
Well, I think, to be quite frank with you, I think Obama will kill McCain. It won't be because the media's helped him. I agree with you, though.
We'd have to draw a distinction between the American media and the American public. I mean, the media came down hard on Clinton for his Monica Lewinsky thing. The American public didn't really care. And, of course, the American public quickly turned on Iraq, and the media kind of slowly followed suit. But still, America is so provincial. And I guess for someone from England, Holland, and born in Ireland, that's even more obvious to you.
You know, I live in New York City, so New York City is not a provincial town, and it's, in fact, the most wonderful town I've ever lived in. And I think that kind of love seeps through this book. So I can't really comment about the rest of the country. The West Coast is obviously somewhere I can fit in very, very easily, too. I mean, San Francisco. I was just in Portland and Seattle the last couple of days, and, you know, these are very amenable towns. But the bit in between, you know, I've been here for 10 years now, and I'm an American citizen now, actually, as of last year, is hair-raising. It's terrifying. And I don't understand it, and I find it really, really hard to understand in political terms. How, on the one hand, you hear about standards of living dropping for the first time since the Great Depression for 3 years in a row or something of that kind. People being terribly aware of this from their own experiences and yet not translating it into voting patterns or political opinions. It's a politically undercooked culture in many places, I would have thought.
Well, you make a comment in an interview that Hahn's political limitations are reflective of limitations in American culture generally. Is that an after-the-fact statement, or is it something you were consciously aware of when you were writing the book?
The whole question of what I'm consciously aware of when I'm writing the book is an interesting one. I'm actually not aware of that much. I'm aware of my characters, I'm aware of the sentences, I'm aware of certain patterns and motifs and certain echoes within the book, and I'm trusting my instincts, and I know every sentence in the book off my head. And then when the text is done, then I look back and I see what it is I've actually intended. the intention becomes retrospective and self-serving in a way. So I should say yes, in answer to your question. I knew that very well when I was writing it. every effect of this book was carefully calculated. But I think Hans is, I think you do become aware that he's being strangely American, actually, in his obtuseness about certain political realities. He's almost radicalized by an encounter with the DMV.
Which is very funny. Did you have an encounter similar to that?
I had to get a new green card, just like he did. It was a nightmare. But for him, it takes this personal setback for him to suddenly rethink his relationship to America. And I think most voters in America, and in fact all over the world, often think in the same terms. They'll think, you can tell them until you're blue in the face that X or Y may be the case of the situation. You can throw statistics at people. But most people will, if they lose their job, or if they, they have problems with at the gas station. That is the kind of stuff which is a politicizing experience.
You're listening to an interview with Joseph O'Neill, whose latest novel is Netherland. The title Netherland is both a pun on Netherlands, which is where he's from, as well as Neverland, as well as just, being an outsider. And that title came from your wife. There was a different title to the book.
Now, what happened is, I was writing, this book was a nightmare to write, years and years and years of writing, but I always consoled myself with the thought that at least I have a great title for this book. And the title was The Brooklyn Dream Game. And I thought, well, it's got Brooklyn in it, which is a recipe for literary success. It's got dream in it, and game. And it's also got the definite article. But then one day, a friend of mine who's a poet says to me, hey, this is Brooklyn Dream Game. That's a great title. He says, do you have any alternatives? And I turned to my wife and I said, what do you think? You think that's a bad title, The Brooklyn Dream Game? And I've been on the record. I've written journalism and, She said, yes, I think it is. I don't think it is a good title. And I sort of get slightly annoyed with her. And I said, you've let me wander around town for 5 years with this terrible title. You never said anything. And then she said, well, why don't you call it Netherland? And I thought, rather grudgingly, all right then. I reserve the right to use The Brooklyn Dream Game in some future bad novel.
You have two earlier novels which were kind of light comedies, and then you wrote your family history, and this book kind of came out of the blue. Obviously, you were conscious you were doing something entirely different and new at this point in your life.
I was conscious that I was in big trouble, if you really must know. I mean, I was conscious that I'd embarked on this. I'd given up my career as a lawyer. I was living in New York City, and I was conscious that year after year, people would say to me, how's the book going? And I'd say, fine. And they'd say, are you still doing that same book, the book about cricket in New York from the point of view of a Dutchman? And, I'd rather shamefully have to admit that it was the same book. And, yes, unfortunately, it was the same narrator and the same unlikely subject. So I was conscious. I became more and more conscious as the years ticked away that I was painting myself into this professional and personal corner. And, it's possible. I mean, I've never really thought about this before, but it's possible that the kind of extremity of that vulnerability translated itself into some kind of artistic ambitiousness, which hadn't maybe... I mean, I've always written as best I can, but maybe in this case I was pushed and pushed to write something I would never have otherwise written. And I do remember, answering your question more directly, I do remember resisting the urge to write a novel which I could have written in a year. You name it, there's lots of novels you can knock out about men going to Vegas or, there's all sorts of novels you can knock out quickly in a year. And I do remember thinking, I have to try and write the novel I can't actually write.
It seems as if you struggled over every single word in the book.
Yeah, I mean, it's, it is a polished book. But it's partly due to the fact that I'm a rather fussy reader. And so if I read a book where I feel the sentences are not particularly, not enough attention has been paid to the sentences, then I sort of abandon it. And I just didn't want the readers. And I know, a reader will toss away a book at the first opportunity. If the reader sees that this is a book which is a conscientious book, then the reader might stick with it.
Three people that the book has been compared to. One is Fitzgerald for Gatsby because of the relationship with Chuck is the anti-Gatsby, as you put him. Another is Saul Bellow, who you said is in your DNA. And the third is John Banville. And I don't know if you've ever read Banville, but when I spoke with Banville, the way he works seems similar to yours.
I have read John Banville. He's an extremely fine writer. His priorities are quite similar to mine. He doesn't write plotty books. He writes books in which, you know, you often have a first-person narrator who sort of lingers over sentences and over motifs and ideas and memories. I would certainly be very honored to be, mentioned in the same breath as John Bamble.
And Bello is somebody that you've always loved.
I'm not that certain about The Adventures of Augie March, which I know so many people love. But Herzog and See the Day are quite extraordinary books.
And the relationship to Gatsby, how conscious was that, or was that on the rewrite? You suddenly go, wait a second.
I think it is that. Yeah, I think it's a sort of. I think you must be off your head if you think that you're going to if you're going to somehow reiterate Gatsby or sort of. I mean, you'd have to be a complete maniac to do that. Gatsby is one of those magical books I think Fitzgerald wrote it in a year. I mean, it sort of popped out of him. And also, he did it without any models. I'm sure if you went back and asked him, he would be able to say, oh, yes, you know, Bertie Snodgrass's novel was a big influence on me, and I picked up so-and-so from... But as far as we can tell, it's this book was just... And this rather modern, intimate voice, which pops out of nowhere, and which still reads as if it was written yesterday. And, yes, so halfway through the book, I suddenly realised, uh-oh, this is the Gatsby plot. You know, drowned... A drowned American dreamer and a bystander who remembers this man. But then I thought, you know what? There are worse books to be similar to.
As you said in an interview, Gatsby could never exist today because we're living in a different era.
Yeah. Chuck Ramkasoon, whose idea is not only to build a cricket stadium but to convert America into cricket, with a view to essentially expanding the American worldview... is a kind of Gatsby figure. I mean, he's a sort of he's this kind of rather idealistic dreamer on the one hand, although Gatsby is only idealistic in terms of love and his personal relationship with Daisy. But Chuck wants to sort of change America as well as make money, and he's also a gangster as well, just as Gatsby was. Chuck ends up dead, and Chuck ends up out of his depth, literally, and drowned. And it's possibly because not because, but one element, as we find out towards the end of the book, is that one of his business partners say, this whole idea that you convert America to cricket is completely irrelevant now. This idea of America as this special place which offers privileged and exclusive opportunities is not a current idea anymore. You can be in Bangalore, you can be in London, you can be in Sao Paulo, you can be an American businessman, just because of the globalized economy and the flow of information that we have now. And in the book, there is a moment towards the end of the book where Hans, back in London, looking back on New York, revisits New York via Google. And he flies over the ocean and goes to New York and has this rather eerie moment looking at the streets of New York. And then he pulls back, up high up into the atmosphere. And then he sees the entire world, and there are no boundaries. It's just this world, this physical planet. And he says the United States is nowhere to be seen. And so we realize at that moment, or at least I realized as I wrote it, that what he's seeing is this kind of new world.
Reading that, I kept thinking about how in the old days, Hollywood geared films to America. Mm. And now you could have movies like Rambo or The Golden Compass, which bomb in America and are hits overseas, and make more money there than they make here. I mean, the entire nature of the world has shifted. It was shifting, I guess, prior to 2000. Maybe just Bush just accelerated it. I don't know.
There are many kind of meanings you can attach to 9/11. But one meaning you can attach in the most casual way, because obviously there are much more grave and awful meanings of that event. But one meaning you can attach is that 9/11 is, in retrospect, a grotesque symbol of the end of the American impenetrability. Not just in terms of its security, but in terms of its kind of economic and cultural privileges.
Accelerated again by...
Exactly.
I mean, you know, when we can't go overseas anymore, I feel like we're in a third world country. I can't afford Europe anymore.
Well, I mean, what happened to the dollar is a kind of... I'm not an economist, but it's certainly referable to what the Bush administration has been doing. And furthermore, it's not just that your dollar is a complete waste of time now. It's also that, you know, as an American, to expose yourself to the wider world is to kind of invite a kind of anger and contempt which wasn't there before, or was there to a much lesser degree. I mean, it's a very sad story.
In 1971, I traveled around with a friend of mine and through Europe with our long hair and backpacks, and we were embarrassed. It was at the height of the Vietnam War. We were embarrassed to say we were Americans and, you know, Canadian, yes, American, no. And here we are 35 years later, and it's the same thing again.
Although this is, it's a less lethal war. I dread to think how many hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese, if not a million Vietnamese, were killed in that war. I'm not sure what the figure is. But this is a less lethal war, but it's a more dishonest war, a more gratuitous war. And for that reason, I think, kind of even more despicable on some level. I mean, it really is a war in which cynical use was made of this attack on New York City. And that's become clearer and clearer now. I mean, you've even got Scott McClellan and all these people who sort of, you know, look back with a certain amount of horror on what they did. Without wishing to give credit too much to these guys, I do accept their description of the Bush administration as this place, as an administration which essentially betrayed its oath, the oath to kind of uphold the Constitution, to serve the people. It's a self-serving administration in the most unthinkably, in the most unthinkable way, really. I mean, part of our reaction to these last 8 years is one of amazement. I don't think many of us have gotten over our amazement. Is it really true that this has been happening? So we'll see.
One thing that's not in that conversation at the dinner table in London that you describe in your book, Joseph O'Neill, is that whenever I talk to somebody from outside the United States, their first comment is, well, okay, we could forgive 2000 because that was a stolen election, but we can't quite forgive 2004. You people actually chose this man.
I'm afraid that's a very telling remark. I mean, I think what happens is you have a classic, an ancient political reality manifests itself in 2004, which is that when the country is at war, and apparently successfully at war, people will, at that point, that was the perception, people will unify behind the warrior leader. I mean, it's the most ancient ruse of them all, and it works yet again. I remember a friend of mine who was a top Democratic political consultant here in California, actually, you know what, he worked for Gray Davis for a while. He told me, you know, after, well, in the prelude before the Iraq war, he said, here's what the timetable is going to be, and he said the war's going to be on this day and it's going to be on this, and then the election's going to be here and they're going to win. And I looked at him and I said, you can't be that cynical. I mean, would they really do anything there? And he laughed at me. He said, of course that's what they're going to do. And this is not someone he wasn't speaking out of some, you know, paranoid conspiracy idea. He was saying, I'm a consultant and I'm telling you this is what they're talking about. And it really was timed with that degree of cynicism, hence this inexplicable rush to war. I mean, there's one thing going to the war, but there was also the rush element and the timetable element, which was very strange because Hans Blix, as we all remember, the great Hans Blix, as we all now know in retrospect, was conducting rather thorough and successful investigations which were revealing nothing, and he wasn't allowed to finish his work.
You know, when you were talking there, I kept thinking of the gas crisis going up high. The gas goes higher and higher, and suddenly McCain and Bush simultaneously say we've got to open up for drilling, you know, the entire coast. And I'm thinking the Bush administration has been trying to pull this nonsense for 8 years, and now suddenly they're making headway just before an election where it could benefit a Republican, and just before they leave office when they could be sure that the contracts go to their pals. And I'm thinking, am I being too cynical to think that this was in some sense planned?
Well, I think you are. I don't think you're being too cynical. I just think you're being too optimistic about the planning capabilities of this government. I mean, which, in addition to everything else, is grotesquely incompetent.
But the political nature of it has been good.
No, you're right. They are very competent. It's an extremely opportunistic government. And my feeling on the war is that, I mean, basically the Bush feeling is that, you know, all this money that's been spent on the war is just money which has stayed in the family, because it's all gone back to Halliburton. So that the sort of pain and expense which the rest of us, and horror with which the rest of us look at this expenditure, apart from anything else, is just not felt by him, because as far as it's just like money going to money in the kitty.
Joseph O'Neill, a couple of final questions. Your previous book, Blood Track, A Family History, concerns these two grandfathers you didn't know, one of whom was imprisoned during World War II as an IRA operative, and the other was a spy for the Axis, or perhaps a spy for the Axis. And I'm just wondering, in your research and in your uncovering of the political stories behind these two men, do you see a connection with the way politics works today that you yourself can draw and maybe that plays an unconscious role in Netherland?
Well, I mean, I think that the question of personal disorientation, the disorientation of a culture and of the narratives, the political narratives in a culture, is definitely one of the things that are going on in Netherland. When I wrote about my grandfathers, I ended up writing about this precise thing. I mean, I looked at these two men, one of whom was an Irish extremist, political extremist, who was interned by the Irish government during the Second World War because they rounded up all the IRA guys because they didn't want England. Let's not forget that in 1939, just before the outbreak of the Second World War, the IRA, and notably my family, was conducting a bombing campaign in London and in other places in England, which was killing civilians. It was an extraordinary, in many ways, horrifying bombing campaign. And then the World War II breaks out, and of course the Irish government says, well, we can't provoke England. Not that they were behind, they were obviously the government, the Irish authorities were against the bombing. So they just rounded up all IRA suspects, including my grandfather and various other members of my family. And they stayed in internment camps for 5 years. Meanwhile, a couple of thousand miles away in Turkey, my Turkish grandfather, who belonged to a small Christian minority there, went to Palestine in 1942 to buy lemons because the lemon market had crashed in Turkey. The lemon market had crashed in Palestine because they couldn't get rid of their lemons, and the lemon crop had crashed in Turkey, so he thought, I'm going to make a profit. So this is a guy who's so on the other extreme of apoliticism that with the world war raging around him, with the Germans invading Egypt, practically, with war in Egypt, I should say, and, you know, the threat of German invasion of Turkey, he still sees this as a sort of good business environment, and he's then arrested by the British in Palestine, who suspect him of being an Axis spy, probably wrongly, although it turns out that there are reasons to suspect him of this. What you have is, I realized, are two exemplars of what I call the blind eye and the dazzled eye. The dazzled eye being the person who is enamored by these very kind of strong political narratives of freedom and idealism and war. You could say the Al-Qaeda people fall into that category. And very honorable people fall into that category too, as we all know. I mean, the American revolutionaries would fall into that category. And then you have the blind eye, which is the person whose political vision is almost non-existent, and Hans is a bit like that in my new book, who doesn't really challenge anything that's being said and just goes with the flow. And a lot of voters in this country and in many other countries are like that. So the question is how do you, in a time of political and global crisis such as the Second World War, and it turns out such as post 9/11, how do you navigate these enormously powerful political currents? And that's a huge challenge for all of us. You know, you see someone, the very interesting example of Christopher Hitchens, who all his life has been toiling with political ideas and is as ready as anybody, in a way, is as qualified as anybody at this junction in history to sort of form a judgment and to get on the right side of history. And what does he do? In my opinion, he goes onto the wrong side of the argument by becoming this neocon, pro-war proselytizer. And you see also the strange grip over the media that these people had. And you suddenly think, well, now I understand how extremist ideas can be absorbed by the powers that be. You know, it's use, and I think a lot of people saw that and were very frightened.
What's interesting about Hitchens is I asked Martin Amis about him. I've never met Hitchens. Amis said, Chris is the same person he always was. Which is odd, because when you're looking at it from a different perspective, it's like he changed, you know, but he didn't. And I think you're right. I think what happens is people get caught up and make these decisions.
It's hard. It's just very hard. I know he's cleverer than me. I suspect he's cleverer than you, because he's cleverer than anybody else in Washington. And yet, for all of this cleverness, it turns out that your judgment ultimately is this mysterious thing.
One thing I find fascinating in talking to you and interviewing writers right and left is that talking to writers, novelists in particular, it's almost across the board the same political opinion. Whereas talk to people who write nonfiction, of course, it's all over the map because that's what they're doing. And I wonder, what is it about fiction? What is it about writing novels? Is it that the novelist who's drawn to it is going to be more perceptive? What do you think that is?
I don't think so. I mean, Martin Amis is a novelist, and his perceptions are not. I wouldn't share many of his perceptions.
But he's a rare example.
He is a rare example. I think what it is that novelists are by their very nature dissatisfied with the way the world accounts for itself. They're dissatisfied with existing narratives of the world, hence their need to embellish, to provide their explanation of the world. So that the explanations that have been dominant and that have been forthcoming from this administration and from its allies, you know, are kind of easily resisted by novelists. It's the idea of resisting those narratives, it comes quite easily. The other thing is I think that a lot of the non-fiction types, writers and commentators, have an interest. A lot of these people, I mean, look at Christopher Hitchens. He must have made a fortune out of espousing these views. And it's not just a question of money, it's also, and I say this with great respect for him in a way, I've got enormous respect for him, I just differ with him fundamentally on this. He's also benefited from a career point of view. I mean, it's made him an extremely important commentator. And I wonder how many of these people make it about themselves. I mean, this interview is possibly the first time I've ever spoken about 9/11. I mean, certainly to this extent, in an interview form. I mean, I have no interest. It doesn't sell my book anymore. It doesn't sort of. My interest is, you know, in writing this novel was not to become a 9/11 commentator, or a commentator about. Although it's fun being a pundit because right. you get things off your chest. But this is like one of the first or second time I've ever discussed these issues, really. So I feel that. In a way, you're slightly removed from the cut and thrust of the argument as a novelist, and I would like to think this vantage point may give you a better sense of what's going on.
Kosher sushi and wewe. I guess...
Pronounce wewe.
Wewe. There is such a thing as wewe, a numbers racket for Trinidadians?
I'm not sure there is wewe in... I don't think there is a numbers racket called wewe in Brooklyn, but, I mean, in Trinidad... Weiwei was a national obsession, so much so that it was that they turned it into the national lottery and they legalized it.
And kosher sushi, you've run across.
Kosher sushi does exist, I'm told.
I had never heard of it. Finally, Joseph O'Neill, now that you've written this, have you had any interest from Hollywood on this? And also, are you working on something else?
I have had interest from Hollywood, although I'm not sure that I'm in a position to talk about that in too much detail. I don't have any particular sort of ambitions for it to become a huge Hollywood film, but if somebody wants to make a good movie out of it, oh, great, so be it. And I am thinking of another book, and I have a very basic and I hope very good idea, but it's such a sort of high concept idea in some ways that I don't really want to go into it now, and nothing may come of it either. I don't want to jinx it.
You've been listening to an interview with Joseph O'Neill, whose latest novel is Netherland. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.